Hello, and welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 26th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. We'll start with today's weather. Today we may have a few thunderstorms, some will be severe, with a high of 66 degrees. Tonight, a damaging evening thunderstorm, with a low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow, Saturday, will be mostly cloudy with a high of 67 degrees. And now we turn to local and state news stories. Things just don't make sense. Trucker's body found. Wife raises questions. No foul play suspected. Dolly A. Butts reports from Sac City, Iowa. No matter the weather or the occasion, Wall Lake, Iowa trucker David Schultz always wore cowboy boots. Schultz's brown Wrangler boots with blue on the soles were how the 53-year-old's body was identified after it was found lying face up in a field roughly 1.5 miles from where his semi-tractor trailer loaded with hogs was discovered abandoned over 5 months ago. He always wore them in the summer and the winter. It didn't matter. He didn't wear work boots, just always cowboy boots and jeans, Sarah Schultz said of her husband, as she stood outside the white single-story Sac City Motel on Thursday morning, her shoulder-length, wavy, light brown hair blowing in the wind. He didn't like it when truck drivers would wear sweatpants and flip-flops. To him, that's just appalling. It's disgusting. He does not respect that. He feels like he's representing the trucking community. Schultz said she has felt relief and sorrow since she learned her husband's body had been discovered by a farmer in his freshly tilled field. The unidentified man found the body shortly before 2 p.m. Wednesday in the vicinity of the intersection of Union Avenue and 190th Street in rural Sac County, northeast of Sac City, according to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, or DCI. I'm glad we know where he is, Schultz said. There's still a lot of questions. You know, things just don't make sense. Late Thursday afternoon, the DCI announced in a statement that the Iowa Office of the State Medical Examiner conducted a forensic autopsy on the body and positively identified it as that of Schultz through dental records. Schultz was located in a farm field in the 1900 block of Union Avenue in Sac County. Preliminary autopsy results show no signs of trauma or serious injury. Further autopsy test results are pending. Authorities do not suspect foul play in the death of Schultz, the statement said. Schultz, a married father of 10-year-old twin boys, vanished before Thanksgiving. He was last heard from in the early morning hours of November 21st, according to the Lakeview Police Department. His red Peterbilt semi with white stripes was found that afternoon parked in the middle of the northbound lane of County Road N14, also known as Union Avenue, not far from where it intersects with D15 or 190th Street. The trailer he rents was loaded with pigs, but Schultz was nowhere to be found on that stretch of paved roadway, which is flanked by cornfields. I can't think of any reason why he would have walked 1.5 miles out into the middle of a field and laid down and taken his coat off and shut his truck down for the day, Schultz said of her husband. Things don't add up, don't line up. I suspect foul play. From what she understood, stands, Schultz said her husband's body was found on its back, clad in a T-shirt, which was pulled up. She said law enforcement didn't show her a photo of the cowboy boots, but she said they were the same brand her husband always wore. He had underwear on, and I think his jeans were down. His cowboy boots were on, I think, she said. I know they identified him by the boots, because the last time he went and bought boots, he bought 2 pairs of the exact same ones. I gave the sheriff one of the newer boots to have for comparison. Jake Rowley, of the United Cajun Navy, said Schultz's body was found in the original 2-mile radius that he had been told law enforcement searched. He said the United Cajun Navy, a nonprofit search and rescue organization which scoured more than 100,000 acres in and around Sac County looking for Schultz, didn't search that particular area. Schultz added that she recalled a thermal imaging drone from the Iowa Department of Transportation flying over. That original area was just marked green out of the gate, because from my understanding, it had been searched by professionals, said Rowley, who asserted that raises baffling questions about whether Schultz's body was there the entire time. The DCI could not be reached by the Journal Thursday morning, and the Sac County Sheriff's Office referred the Journal to the DCI. Neither Schultz nor Rowley has viewed the body. Schultz has trouble grasping how her husband's body wasn't just bones, given the length of time that has passed since his disappearance and the relatively mild winter Northwest Iowa experienced. She said she had a feeling her husband would be found when the farmers would be readying their fields. I can't believe it wasn't just bones by now, knowing there's animals, vultures, coyotes, and what they made it sound, nothing was missing. It wasn't just bones, so I don't understand, she said. Schultz regularly posted updates on her Facebook page about her husband's case. She previously called his disappearance suspicious and said, "This is not something David would do. He would never leave. His family is his life." During a December 14th interview with the Journal, Schultz expressed frustration with local law enforcement and said she felt the case was more than small-town police can handle. When asked how she currently feels about how the investigation into her husband's disappearance was handled, Schultz said, "I don't really want to talk about that." Schultz, who works as a safety coordinator for EVAPCO in Lakeview, said she learned her husband's body had been found from her boss. She said he tricked her into going for a car ride. Since it was such a nice day out, she got into his truck. As she drove, they talked about work stuff. I didn't understand it all until we got to about my house, and he grabbed my hand and said, "I know you've been through a lot this year. The sheriff called, and he wants to meet at your house to talk to you." So I knew, Schultz said, her voice quaking and her eyes filling with tears. Wrestlers' parents file lawsuits. Suits claim Hinton coaches encouraged physical, mental intimidation. Nick Heitrek reports from Hinton, Iowa. Two Hinton wrestlers and their parents have sued the school district, administrators, and coaches, saying they enabled a wrestling program that was, quote, a breeding ground for harassment and bullying, end quote, culminating in incidents in which underclassmen allegedly were assaulted with sex toys and an electric stun gun. After learning of the incidents, coaches did not inform parents or school administrators or try to prevent future incidents, instead telling wrestlers to delete social media accounts that could get the students and coaches in trouble. The district was aware that bullying, hazing, and violence were a problem on the wrestling team and did nothing to stop it. In fact, the actions of the coaches and athletic director encouraged the behavior. They personally witnessed it on many occasions, the lawsuit said. Filed earlier this month in Plymouth County District Court, the lawsuits allege negligence by the school district, Superintendent Ken Slater, then head coach Casey Crawford, assistant coach Bradley Woody Squotus, and athletic director Brian DeJong. The lawsuits also claim negligent supervision by the school district, which the suit said did not have adequate measures in place to prevent the behavior or protect students from it, and did not train its employees how to respond to bullying, assault, and sadomasochistic abuse by its students. Slater referred questions to the district's attorneys, Timothy and Zachary Clausen of Sioux City. The lawsuits and the division they have caused in the Hinton School District community are certainly unfortunate. While the district intends to zealously defend against the claims, it is district policy to not comment on pending litigation, especially when such litigation involves minor students of the district. The administration, faculty, and staff of the district will continue to work tirelessly toward improving all academic and extracurricular programs to provide a positive and safe learning environment for the benefit of all students, Timothy Clausen said in an email to the Journal Thursday. The lawsuits paint a picture of a wrestling program in which coaches encouraged physical and mental intimidation. Common during practice were games such as slapback, in which wrestlers were slapped on the back so hard that marks remained for days, and target, in which individuals, usually a junior varsity team member, were pelted with dodgeballs by the rest of the team with the goal to hit the student as hard as possible. The coaches were well aware of all of the above described practices and were present for much, if not all of it, the suits said, and coaches did not end them after being confronted by parents about it. The lawsuit said wrestlers were choked out, tripped, punched, and shoved in the locker room during practice and meets. Some wrestlers were so afraid of being in the locker room, the suit said, they would change their clothes in their vehicles and would not shower at school. The behavior intensified during two trips in which the team stayed at hotels while participating in tournaments during this past season. While at a tournament in Omaha in January, the suit said, wrestlers were allowed to leave the hotel and go to a mall where several wrestlers bought dildos and other sex toys. That night at the hotel, some students forcibly used dildos on other wrestlers, holding one wrestler down while another wrestler shoved a dildo down the boy's throat. Wrestlers took photos and videos and sent them to members of the team's group Snapchat social media account. According to the lawsuits, coaches later became aware of the sex items and claimed to have confiscated them, but didn't inform any parents or school administrators about what had happened. On the weekend of February 2nd and 3rd, while staying in a Coralville, Iowa hotel for the state dual wrestling tournament, underclassmen were targeted by some older team members, the suits said. The lawsuits said one of the upperclassmen involved in the alleged assault in Omaha brought a stun gun. On the nights of February 2nd and 3rd, a Friday and Saturday, three upperclassmen, who the lawsuit said were known by school officials to have caused problems in the past with their violent and bullying behavior, shocked freshmen with the stun gun. Two of the upperclassmen would restrain a freshman on a bed and hold their hands over his mouth, while a third upperclassman shocked him. Other freshmen were shocked while standing up, and some agreed to shock themselves after being threatened by the upperclassmen and asked, "Would you like to do this the easy way or the hard way?" One freshman who had been held down and shocked on Friday night was held down again on Saturday and threatened. In a video of the incident, a student states the upperclassman appeared to torture the freshman, the lawsuit said. The lawsuit said Crawford, Skuotis, and DeJong, who accompanied the team as the athletic director, did not check on wrestlers' rooms during the entire stay, and instead had taken the two free drink vouchers each room received and were in or near the hotel lobby drinking alcohol while the alleged assaults occurred. By Sunday, coaches were aware of the incidents, the suits said, but did not inform parents, who became aware of the incidents later that day after a parent found video of them on a wrestler's phone. That parent contacted other parents and an assistant coach, who, according to the lawsuit, said he would initiate the reporting process, but also said this could negatively affect the wrestling program. On Monday, Crawford sent an email to the team at 6:45 a.m. that included the practice schedule and a team dinner, but did not mention the alleged shocking incidents. That same morning, a mother of one of the wrestlers who had been assaulted went to the school and showed a video of the incident to the guidance counselor, who notified Slater. At a team meeting that afternoon, the lawsuits said, Crawford yelled at wrestlers about what had happened, specifically with sex toys and stun guns, telling them, "This is how coaches get effing fired." He then told them to delete the Snapchat group chat from their phones because it would get him and them in trouble. Crawford and Skuotis were placed on administrative leave, but Crawford was allowed to continue in his teaching position, conducting a homeroom period for one of the victims and teaching two of the other victims in a class. Coralville police received a call the day after the tournament about a possible assault involving the Hinton wrestlers. Police Chief Shane Cron said in February he could not comment on the case during the investigation and would not release the juveniles' names. Cron did not respond Thursday to voicemail and email inquiries about the status of the investigation. Team members' behaviors also led to a Hinton police investigation. Police Chief James Conway said in February he could not comment on an ongoing investigation. He did not respond Thursday to messages inquiring if the investigation has been completed. Plymouth County Attorney Darren Raymond said he was aware of the allegations but had no comment on any investigations, charges, or other matters within juvenile court. In most cases, except those involving the most serious crimes, juvenile court files are confidential. The three students believed to be the perpetrators were suspended for 10 days and did not wrestle in the district meet, preventing them from possibly qualifying for the individual state tournament. The school board ultimately voted 3-1 during a special session to reassign two of the three from school. Skuotis was reinstated to his coaching position after serving 2 days on administrative leave and coached the team at the state individual wrestling tournament in Des Moines, where team members wrote T-shirts saying, "Free Crawford." Crawford resigned his coaching position in March. He did not respond to a text message seeking comment. Skuotis remains on a contract through the school year. DeJong, who also was the middle school principal, submitted his resignation, effective in June, in March. He was not at school Thursday and did not return messages seeking comment. The parents, who are represented by Des Moines attorneys Allison Kenny and Ruben Neff, said in the lawsuits their sons have suffered mental, physical, and emotional distress. They are seeking damages in an amount to be determined at trial and punitive damages. The parents' names are listed in court filings, but the journal is not referring to them by name in order to protect the identities of their sons, who are referred to in the lawsuits only by their initials. And now we turn to national and world news. In the Supreme Court about the Trump immunity claim, justices seem unmoved. Ex-president could get a delay if case is sent back to lower courts. Mark Sherman reports from Washington. The Supreme Court on Thursday appeared likely to reject former President Donald Trump's claim of absolute immunity from prosecution over election interference, but it seemed possible Trump could still benefit from a lengthy trial delay, possibly beyond November's election. Chief Justice John Roberts was among at least 5 members of the court who did not appear to embrace the claim of absolute immunity that would stop Special Counsel Jack Smith's prosecution of Trump on charges he conspired to overturn his 2020 election loss to Democrat Joe Biden. But in arguments lasting more than 2.5 hours in the court's first consideration of criminal charges against a former president, Roberts also was among several justices who suggested the case might have to be sent back to lower courts before a trial could begin. Roberts indicated he was unhappy with the reasoning adopted by the federal appeals court that ruled against Trump. The timing of the Supreme Court's decision could be as important as the outcome. Trump, the presumptive 2024 Republican presidential nominee, pushed to delay the trial until after the election, and the later the justices issue their decision, the more likely he is to succeed. The active questioning by all 9 justices left the strong impression that the court was not headed for the sort of speedy, consensus decision that would allow a trial to begin quickly. Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, 2 of Trump's 3 high court appointees, suggested that former presidents might have some immunity and that in this case, lower courts might have to sort out whether that applied to Trump. That could further delay a trial. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the other Trump appointee, seemed less open to arguments advanced by Trump lawyer D. John Sauer. Smith's team wants a speedy resolution. The court typically issues its last opinions by the end of June, about 4 months before the election. Trump's lawyers argue that former presidents are entitled to absolute immunity for their official acts. Otherwise, they say, politically motivated prosecutions of former occupants of the Oval Office would become routine, and presidents couldn't function as the commander-in-chief if they had to worry about criminal charges. Lower courts rejected those arguments, including a unanimous 3-judge panel on an appeals court in Washington, D.C. And in the Trump hush money criminal trial, ex-publisher describes scheme. Former Inquirer chief shielded his friend from damaging stories. From New York. As Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, his old friend at the National Enquirer scooped up potentially damaging stories about the candidate and paid out tens of thousands of dollars to keep them from the public eye. But when it came to the seamy claims by porn performer Stormy Daniels, David Pecker, the tabloid's longtime publisher, said he put his foot down. "I am not paying for this story," he told jurors Thursday at Trump's hush money trial, recounting his version of a conversation with Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, about the catch-and-kill scheme that prosecutors allege amounted to interference in the race. Pecker was already $180,000 in the hole on other Trump-related stories by the time Daniels came along, at which point he said, "I didn't want to be involved in this." Pecker's testimony was a critical building block for the prosecution's theory that their partnership was a way to illegally influence the 2016 presidential election. Trump's lawyers also began their cross-examination of Pecker, using the time to question his memory of years-old events and to suggest his account had evolved over time. Trump maintains his innocence and says the stories that were bought and squelched were false. Pecker testified how he and his publication parlayed rumor mongering into splashy stories that smeared Trump's opponents and, just as crucially, leveraged his connections to suppress unflattering coverage. He recalled that the publication bought a sordid tale from a New York City doorman and purchased accusations of an extramarital affair with former Playboy model Karen McDougal to prevent the claims from getting out. There was some talk of reimbursement from Trump's orbit, but Pecker was ultimately never paid. The breaking point came with Daniels, who was eventually paid by Cohen to keep quiet over her claim of a 2006 sexual encounter with Trump. Pecker advised that someone should do something to prevent the story from going public. "I said to Michael, my suggestion to you is that you should buy the story, and you should take it off the market, because if you don't and it gets out, I believe the boss will be very angry with you." New York appeals court tosses Weinstein's 2020 case. Convicted rapist will remain in prison for Los Angeles sentence. From New York. New York's highest court on Thursday overturned Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction, reversing a landmark ruling of the Me Too era. The court found the trial judge unfairly allowed testimony against him based on allegations that weren't part of the case. Weinstein, 72, will remain in prison because he was convicted in Los Angeles in 2022 of another rape. But the New York ruling reopens a painful chapter in America's reckoning with sexual misconduct by powerful figures, an era that began in 2017 with a flood of allegations against Weinstein. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office said it intends to retry Weinstein, and at least one of his accusers said she would testify again. Weinstein has been in a New York prison since his conviction for forcibly performing oral sex on a TV and film production assistant in 2006, and rape in the third degree for an attack on an aspiring actress in 2013. He was sentenced to 16 years in prison in the Los Angeles case. Weinstein's lawyers expect Thursday's court ruling to have a major impact on the appeal of his Los Angeles rape conviction. Their arguments are due May 20th. Some schools call police to stop demonstrations. University of Southern California cancels big graduation ceremony. The University of Southern California canceled its main graduation ceremony, and dozens more college students were arrested at other campuses nationwide Thursday as protests against the Israel-Hamas war spread. College officials across the U.S. are worried protests could disrupt plans for commencement ceremonies. Some universities called in police to break up demonstrations, resulting in scuffles and hundreds of arrests, while others appeared content to wait out protests as the semester ticks down. Some schools, such as Columbia University in New York and California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, tried to negotiate a solution with protesters. Other universities are rewriting their rules to ban encampments and moving final exams to new locations. Encampments and protests continued to spring up Thursday. Students protesting the war demand schools cut financial ties to Israel and divest from companies enabling the conflict. Some Jewish students say the protest veered into anti-Semitism and made them afraid to set foot on campus. Report shows economy slowed last quarter. From Washington. The U.S. economy slowed sharply last quarter to a 1.6% annual pace in the face of high interest rates. But consumers, the main driver of economic growth, kept spending at a solid pace. The U.S. Commerce Department reported Thursday the gross domestic product, the economy's total output of goods and services, decelerated in the January through March quarter from its 3.4% growth rate in the last 3 months of 2023. The core components of the economy appeared sturdy, but there are still price pressures. A measure of inflation accelerated to a 3.4% annual rate from January through March, up from 1.8% in the last 3 months of 2023. From January through March, consumer spending rose at a 2.5% annual rate, a solid pace, though down from a rate of more than 3% in the previous two quarters. Spending on services rose 4%, the fastest such pace since mid-2021. Reservist testifies on Maine mass shooter. From Augusta, Maine. An Army reservist and friend of the gunman behind Maine's deadliest mass shooting testified Thursday about his friend's mental decline, describing publicly for the first time the warning he issued a month before the killings. Sean Hodgson texted leaders of his reserve unit 6 weeks before the October 25th shooting left 18 people dead and 13 wounded, telling them to change the passcode to the gate at their Army Reserve training facility and arm themselves if Robert Card showed up. Hodgson told superiors on September 15th, "I believe he's going to snap and do a mass shooting." Several other reservists witnessed Card's deterioration, leading to his two-week hospitalization in July, and relatives warned police they were concerned about his access to guns. Card, 40, was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound after the shootings. Authorities' failure to remove his weapons is the subject of an investigative commission in the state, which also passed new gun safety laws. Once again, you are listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 26th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We continue with national and world news briefs. Net neutrality. The Federal Communications Commission restored net neutrality rules Thursday that prevent broadband internet providers from favoring some sites and apps over others. Air pollution. U.S. coal-fired power plants would be forced to capture smokestack emissions or shut down under a rule the Environmental Protection Agency issued Thursday. Abortion. Republican attorneys general from 17 states filed a lawsuit Thursday challenging new federal rules entitling workers to time off and other accommodations for abortions, calling the rules an illegal interpretation of a 2022 federal law. Ukraine war. Ukraine sidelined U.S.-provided Abrams battle tanks, in part because Russian drone warfare made it too difficult for them to operate without detection or coming under attack, two U.S. military officials said Thursday. Five of the 31 tanks already were lost. Gaza. A senior U.S. military official told reporters Thursday the U.S. is on track to begin delivering more food and other humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip by early May, using a new port and pier under construction. And finally, Baltimore. The first cargo ship passed through a newly opened deep water channel Thursday in Baltimore after being stuck in the harbor since the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed 4 weeks ago. And now we turn to sports. In Major League Baseball, Franz Urias home runs lift Mariners. From Arlington, Texas, Ty France and Luis Urias hit two-run homers. Luis Castillo pitched six solid innings, and the Seattle Mariners beat the Texas Rangers 4-3 on Thursday, taking two of three in the series and leaving with first place in the AL West. Julio Rodriguez, leading off after shortstop J.P. Crawford went on the injured list with a right oblique strain, opened with a single and scored on France's first homer of the season. Brewers 7, Pirates 5. Gary Sanchez hit a pinch hit, two-run home run in the eighth inning to lift Milwaukee to a road victory over Pittsburgh and a series split. Sanchez drove a 0-2 sinker from Aroldis Chapman 371 feet to right with two outs, putting the Brewers ahead 6-5. Two of his three home runs came this series, including on Tuesday when he produced Milwaukee's lone run in a 2-1 loss. Guardians 6, Red Sox 4. Jose Ramirez belted his sixth career Grand Slam and had three hits. Will Brennan had a solo homer, and host Cleveland beat Boston. Cleveland has the best record in the American League at 18-7 and matched the second-best mark in franchise history through 25 games. The Guardians won their season series against Boston 5-2, all in an 11-day span. Phillies 5, Reds nothing. Bryce Harper homered in his return to the lineup following the birth of his third child, and Philadelphia won at Cincinnati for its second shutout in splitting a four-game series. Zach Wheeler allowed one hit in six innings, a third-inning single by Santiago Espinal. He struck out eight and walked four, extending his scoreless streak to 13 1/3 innings. Twins 6, White Sox 3. Chicago dropped to 3-22, wasting a two-run lead and stretching its losing streak to a season-high 7, with a road loss to Minnesota as Edward Julian hit two of the Twins' five solo home runs. Julian and Jose Miranda homered in a three-run sixth inning off Michael Soroka. Julian homered again off John Brebbia in the seventh, and Carlos Santana and Jose Miranda went deep against Steven Wilson in the eighth. Cubs 3, Astros 1. Pete Crow Armstrong hit a tie-breaking two-run homer for his first major league hit, and host Chicago swept Houston. Rockies 10, Padres 9. Elias Diaz capped Colorado's six-run eighth inning with a tie-breaking RBI double as the Rockies rallied to beat visiting San Diego. Dodgers 2, Nationals 1. Yoshinobu Yamamoto pitched six shutout innings, and Los Angeles defeated Washington to complete a three-game road sweep. Royals 2, Blue Jays 1 in 5. Salvador Perez hit a two-run homer in the first inning. Cole Reagans held Toronto in check long enough for the rain to arrive, and host Kansas City won a game called after five innings and a long weather delay. And finally, A's 3, Yankees 1. Mason Miller retired Aaron Judge with a runner on for his first four-out save, and Oakland won at New York to split a four-game series. In other Major League Baseball news, Mariners Crawford placed on 10-day injured list. From Arlington, Texas. Leadoff hitting shortstop J.P. Crawford was placed on the 10-day injured list Thursday because of a right oblique strain. The move came a day after Crawford was a late scratch from the Mariners lineup before their 5-1 loss at Texas. He felt his oblique tweak during batting practice. "I do not have a timeline for JP. We'll evaluate it as it goes along," manager Scott Servais said. "We hope to get him back as soon as possible." Dylan Moore was the starting shortstop for the series finale Thursday against the Rangers. Center fielder Julio Rodriguez moved up to leading off from his usual number two spot. Royals Marsh on the injured list. Camp from Kansas City, Missouri. The Kansas City Royals placed right-hander Alec Marsh on the injured list Thursday after he took a 91-mile-per-hour liner off his pitching elbow the previous night against the Blue Jays, putting what had been a breakout season for him on hold. X-rays taken after the game showed no fractures, but the ball hit near the flexor tendon and the Royals opted for caution. Baker. Dusty Baker won the fourth Lifetime Achievement Award presented by Baseball Digest. The beloved Baker retired following the 2023 season after spending 56 years in the majors as a player, coach, and manager. Cubs. Chicago reliever Luke Little said he had to change his glove before he entered Wednesday's 4-3 victory over Houston because of an American flag patch. A's. Oakland second baseman Zach Gelof was put on the 10-day injured list because of his strained left oblique. Gelof was a late scratch from Wednesday's game after an MRI showed the low-grade strain. And the Major League Baseball stat of the day, 3. The Chicago White Sox matched the 20-02 Cincinnati Reds, 20-03 Detroit Tigers, and 18-94 Washington Senators by starting the season with a 3-22 record. The 1988 Baltimore Orioles opened their season 2-23. And in stories from the NBA, Magic bounced back in big way with rout of Cavaliers. From Orlando, Florida. Paolo Banchero had 31 points and 14 rebounds. Jalen Suggs added 24 points, and the Orlando Magic handed Cleveland the worst playoff loss in franchise history, winning 121-83 on Thursday night to cut the Cavaliers' lead to 2-1 in their Eastern Conference first-round series. Franz Wagner finished with 16 points and 8 assists for the Magic, who led by 43 points in the fourth quarter on the way to the third-largest margin of victory in a playoff game. They earned their first playoff victory since 2019, and the first on their home floor since April 26, 2011. They can even the series on Saturday with a victory at home. Jarrett Allen had 15 points and 8 rebounds for the Cavs, who shot 39% from the field and 23.5% from three-point range. Caris LeVert added 15 points, and Donovan Mitchell had 13 points and 7 assists. The Cavs' previous worst loss was a 36-point defeat against Washington on April 24, 2008. Orlando never had a lead during the first two games in Cleveland, but blew this one open in the third quarter. Mitchell, Allen, and Cleveland starters Evan Mobley and Max Strus were taken out of the game with 3 minutes and 16 seconds left in the period, and the Cavaliers down 92-58. After missing 10 of their first 11 shots and falling behind by 7, the Magic made 34 of their next 52 field goal attempts and finished the game at 51.1%, or 47-92. 76ers 125, Knicks 114. Joel Embiid scored 50 points, making all 4 three-point attempts and scoring 18 in a potential series-shifting third quarter to lead host Philadelphia over New York. With one of the finest postseason efforts of his career, Embiid became the third player to ever score 50 points against the Knicks in the postseason and kept the hope of a Philadelphia series comeback very much alive. The Knicks lead the series 2-1. Game 4 is Sunday in Philadelphia. Embiid was 13 of 19 from the floor overall, made 19 of 21 free throws, and hit 5 three-pointers. Last season's NBA MVP, Embiid finally turned the crowd, which had a distinct New York flavor in South Philly, into one rocking for the home team. The All-Star Center played more like a sharpshooting guard in the third. In other NBA news, Embiid says he has Bell's palsy. From Philadelphia, 76ers All-Star center Joel Embiid has been diagnosed with Bell's palsy, a form of facial paralysis he says has affected him since before the play-in tournament. Embiid wore sunglasses to the podium after he scored 50 points in the Sixers Game 3 win over the New York Knicks and said he's battled various symptoms such as blurred vision and dry eyes. Embiid said he first started suffering from the affliction about a day or two before the Sixers played the Miami Heat on April 17th in the play-in tournament. Embiid had 23 points and 15 rebounds in the win that sent the Sixers to the playoffs. Embiid complained of migraines but thought it was nothing before he finally notified doctors he wasn't feeling well. I was just not feeling it, Embiid said. Yes, it's pretty annoying. My left side of my face, my mouth, and my eye. It's been tough, but I'm not a quitter. I'm going to keep fighting through anything. It's unfortunate that that's the way I look at it, but it's not an excuse. I've got to keep pushing. Curry named NBA's Clutch Player of the Year. Golden State's Stephen Curry led the league in clutch scoring this season, and now he's got another trophy to add to his collection. Curry was announced Thursday night as the NBA's Clutch Player of the Year, adding that award to a resume that includes two MVPs, an All-Star Game MVP, an NBA Finals MVP, a Western Conference Finals MVP, and 9 All-NBA selections. And the NBA stat of the day, 23. The Miami Heat connected on 23 three-pointers, tying the second most in franchise history for any game and setting a team record for a playoff game, on the way to a 111-101 win over top-seeded Boston Wednesday night to even their Eastern Conference series at a game apiece. In NHL news, Panthers push rival to the brink. From Tampa, Florida, Sergei Bobrovsky made 26 saves, Matthew Tkachuk scored twice, and the Florida Panthers beat the Tampa Bay Lightning 5-3 on Thursday night to take a 3-0 lead in their first-round playoff series. Brandon Montour, Sam Reinhart, and Steven Lawrence also scored for the Panthers, who will seek a sweep Saturday in Tampa. Tkachuk had a first-period goal and added an empty netter with 32 seconds left. Steven Stamkos, Tyler Motte, and Nicholas Paul scored for Tampa Bay, with Paul cutting it to 4-3 with 5 minutes and 10 seconds left. Andrei Vasilevskiy stopped 26 shots. Montour gave Florida a 3-2 lead on a blue line shot with 3 minutes and 30 seconds left in the second, with Lorenz making it a 2-goal game from the slot at 9 minutes and 41 seconds of the third. After withstanding several minutes of sustained pressure at the defensive end, Florida tied it at 2 on Reinhardt's goal at 9 minutes and 58 of the second. The Lightning, with the NHL's top regular season power play, went 0-4. Florida did not have a power play. Hurricanes 3, Islanders 2. Defensemen Brent Burns and Dmitry Orlov got Carolina off to a fast start, and the Hurricanes held on to beat New York on Long Island for a 3-0 lead in the first-round series. Sebastian Aho also scored for the Hurricanes. Andrei Svechnikov had 2 assists, and Frederick Anderson stopped 29 shots. Carolina won for the 8th time in 9 games at UBS Arena, which opened for the 2021-22 season. Brock Nelson and Pierre Engvall scored for the Islanders. They are a loss away from being eliminated by Carolina in the first round for the second straight year. Ilya Sorokin getting the start after Semyon Varlamov went in the first two games, was pulled in the second period after giving up 3 goals on 14 shots. Varlamov came on and stopped all 8 shots he faced. With the Hurricanes leading 3-2, Anderson made a nice save falling backward on a shot by Alexander Romanov about 6.5 minutes into the third period. The puck lay in the paint briefly before the goalie covered it up. In other NHL news, Kraken move games to over-the-air TV. From Seattle, the Seattle Kraken will move their games to an over-the-air broadcaster and have a streaming partnership with Amazon's Prime Video, beginning with the 2024-25 season, the team announced Thursday. The Kraken will be the first NHL team to have a streaming deal with Prime Video for all non-nationally televised games, which will be available to Amazon Prime members in Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. They are the third individual team to have a streaming partnership with Prime Video, joining the New York Yankees and the Seattle Storm. Amazon CEO Andy Jassy has a minority stake in the ownership group of the Kraken. Blackhawks reached deal with Vlasic from Chicago. The Chicago Blackhawks agreed to a 6-year contract with defenseman Alex Vlasic, rewarding one of their best young players with a long-term deal. The team announced the move on Thursday. The contract runs through the 2029-30 season with a $4.6 million salary cap hit. Cole, voice of hockey in Canada, dies at 90. Bob Cole, the voice of hockey in Canada for a half century, who served as the soundtrack for some of the national sport's biggest moments, has died. He was 90. Friend and fellow broadcaster John Shannon said Cole died Wednesday night in his hometown of St. John's. And finally, the NHL stat of the day. 1. In the first two games of the Capital Series against the Rangers, Washington's Alex Ovechkin had only 1 shot on goal. And in the NFL draft, Williams to Bears starts the quarterback parade. Daniels may follow. 6 quarterbacks go in top 12. From Detroit, Caleb Williams swiftly walked on stage, looked out and screamed, "Woo, yeah!" Long-suffering Bears fans felt his joy. Williams is heading to the Windy City, aiming to become the franchise quarterback Chicago has sought for decades. The 2022 Heisman Trophy winner kicked off an historic NFL draft Thursday night that had 5 other teams selecting quarterbacks among the top 12 picks, setting a record with 5 in the top 10 and tying a record for the most in the first round. Nearly the entire first half of the draft was offensive players. A defensive player wasn't selected until UCLA edge rusher Latu went at number 15 to Indianapolis. That's the latest a first defensive player has ever gone. The Bears opened with the easy choice, taking Williams at number 1 after deciding weeks ago to bank on the 2022 Heisman Trophy winner from USC. Care, love, and support, and want to win, Williams said about what he's bringing to Chicago. The Washington Commanders followed up by taking 2023 Heisman Trophy winner Jaden Daniels from LSU, and the New England Patriots took North Carolina's Drake May at number 3, making it the 4th draft with quarterbacks going with the first 3 picks. It matched 2021, whose picks were Trevor Lawrence, Zach Wilson, and Trey Lance, 1971 with Jim Plunkett, Archie Manning, and Dan Pastorini, and 1999 with Tim Couch, Donovan McNabb, and Akili Smith. At number 8, the Atlanta Falcons made a stunning decision to choose Washington quarterback Michael Penix Jr., despite signing Kirk Cousins to a massive contract in free agency. The Minnesota Vikings traded up one spot and took J.J. McCarthy, who led Michigan to a national championship to make it 5 quarterbacks in the top 10 for the first time. The Denver Broncos chose Oregon's Bo Nix with the 12th pick, tying the 1983 draft with 6 quarterbacks in the first round. 3 of those became Hall of Famers, John Elway, Dan Marino, and Jim Kelly. Todd Blackledge Tony Eason and Ken O'Brien also went in the first round in 1983. The Arizona Cardinals snapped the early quarterback trend, choosing Ohio State wide receiver Marvin Harrison Jr. with the fourth pick. The Los Angeles Chargers opened the Jim Harbaugh era by taking Notre Dame offensive tackle Joe Ault instead of giving Justin Herbert a number one wide receiver to replace Keenan Allen and Mike Williams. The New York Giants then snatched up LSU receiver Malik Nabers at number six. The Tennessee Titans took Alabama offensive tackle J.C. Latham with the seventh pick, and the Bears selected Washington wideout Rome Odunze at number nine. The New York Jets, who dropped to number 11, chose offensive tackle Olu Fashanu, giving Aaron Rodgers more protection. The Las Vegas Raiders got Georgia tight end Brock Bowers at number 13. The New Orleans Saints took Oregon State offensive tackle Talies Fuaga with the 14th pick before the Colts grabbed Latu. Previously, the latest a first defensive player was selected was number 8. Latu started a short trend. The Seattle Seahawks took Texas defensive tackle Byron Murphy next, and the Vikings made another trade to move up and take Alabama edge Dallas Turner at number 17. Rap icon Eminem walked on stage in a Lions sweatshirt and cap shortly after Goodell to start the festivities. The Motor City native riled up the fans before turning it over to Lions star Goff, Aiden Hutchinson, Amon-Ra St. Brown, and Hall of Famers Barry Sanders and Calvin Johnson. St. Brown led them in chanting, "Jared Goff," and Johnson kept it short, "What up, Joe?" An estimated crowd of 150,000, many wearing their Honolulu Blue Lions jerseys, filled the streets surrounding the Draft Theater and turned the NFL's biggest off-season event into a giant party. Williams is the third quarterback Chicago has selected in the first round in the past 8 years. Mitch Trubisky, the number 2 overall pick in 2017, lasted 4 seasons. Justin Fields, the 11th pick in 2021, was traded away for a conditional 6th-round pick after 3 seasons. Williams was the clear front-runner in a quarterback-rich draft. The Bears didn't meet with any other QBs, and Williams didn't visit any other teams. He impressed his future team over dinner with several Bears players last month, showing them he's more substance than Hollywood style. The Bears are the only NFL franchise that hasn't had a quarterback throw for 4,000 yards or 30 touchdowns in a season. They passed up on Bryce Young and C.J. Stroud last year and traded the number one pick to Carolina in a blockbuster deal, only to get the top choice this year after the Panthers went 2-15. The 23-year-old Daniels, who played 3 seasons at Arizona State and 2 at LSU, gives the Commanders a potential franchise quarterback after leading the nation in total offense last season with 4,946 yards. A do-it-all player, Daniels ranked 5th with 3,812 yards passing and with 40 touchdowns. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 26th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.